Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
He said something to the effect of, you know, Harvey's a really nice name, but, you know, the storm, not nice. Not nice.
He was actually watching TV. He didn't even look up. He said, I think empathy will be one of the strongest parts of Trump. He almost conveyed it as a commodity, as something to sort of show off when the time came.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast, the show that takes a close look at Donald Trump and all of his adventures. My name is Jamel Bowie. I am Slate's chief political correspondent and your host for today's show. It is far too early to say if Hurricane Harvey is the disaster of the century, but it may well stand as the disaster of the year. Houston, Texas is underwater, flooded by unprecedented rains, and the extent of the damage and death is unknown. What we do know is that the federal government faces the major challenge of rebuilding and reconstruction, a task complicated by the people in charge. Despite photo ops and the occasional words of encouragement, there is little sign that President Trump is engaged with the details of recovery and relief. Congress still needs to pass an aid package for affected regions, and it also has to keep the government open so that key agencies like FEMA can do their jobs. This early period of response is critical. When it's mismanaged, as was true for Hurricane Katrina in 2005, it can exacerbate the damage of the storm itself, turning a natural disaster into an outright catastrophe. But even if authorities manage to stick the landing and provide adequate relief and guidance, we're still looking at a Houston forever changed by the flood and its consequences. And we can look to Katrina for a possible future. There, in New Orleans, a city that once had a large, vibrant black middle class and black political class, has changed dramatically, losing much of that earlier population and now becoming a place that in many respects is unrecognizable from what it was. We don't know Houston's future. But that doesn't mean we can't discuss the challenges and pitfalls it will face as it begins to rebuild. Our guest today is Gary Rivlin, author of the 2015 book Katrina, After the Flood. We'll talk to Gary in a moment, but first, a word from our sponsors. To talk about Hurricane Harvey, disasters, the whole nine yards, we have Gary Rivlin, author of Katrina, After the Flood. Hi, Gary. Welcome to TrumpCast.
Great to be here.
So in the intro to this episode, I spoke a little bit about Hurricane Harvey and drawing a bit of a connection to Katrina as the other kind of major hurricane that flooded an American city. And so my first question for you is in the public consciousness, Katrina is sort of synonymous with not just the hurricane and the disaster itself, but also the somewhat bungled aftermath. Observing Harvey, observing sort of the beginnings of the response to Harvey, do you see authorities making any of the same mistakes they made in New Orleans?
No, I mean, the advantage that any administration, any FEMA director has after Katrina is Katrina changed the world. You know, if you just look at the polling numbers for George Bush, president at the time, that's the inflection point. It was 2005, summer of 2005, and his poll numbers fell nearly 20 percentage points and never recovered. I mean, they went up after that, but they never went back to where they were prior to Katrina. And I think the lesson for every administration is, wow, we really need to pay attention. One of the great shames of Katrina, I mean, there's many shames of Katrina, but it was a practice session, Hurricane Pam, a FEMA-led training a year before the actual storm. And they anticipated almost exactly what Katrina was, a slow-moving Category 3 hitting New Orleans at the angle it did. And said we have to have this many truckloads of water and food, etc. And they had it all on paper. They just did not send the truckloads of food and water, etc., that they said. And I think the lesson for every administration after that is we better pay attention to this. Otherwise, this might be the end of our administration as well. So the one thing that does strike me is a huge difference. I mean, with a caveat, I was down in New Orleans for 8 months living after Katrina. I'm just now sitting in New York City reading the newspaper, watching TV, listening to podcasts, just like everyone else. But, you know, kind of the storyline I'm getting from Harvey is heartening. It's, you know, people working together, you know, rich, poor, black, white, doesn't make a Latino, doesn't make a difference. That was not New Orleans. I mean, one of the untold parts of Katrina, of New Orleans after Katrina, was it showed the ugly side. It wasn't like people came together in a storm. It was actually quite the opposite.
Right. Those, for me, I was, this will tell you how young I am. I had just started college when Hurricane Katrina hit. And the images that are most striking to me that I remember most are those of armed, heavily armed police, sort of confrontations between black residents of New Orleans and police, a kind of sense that New Orleans hadn't just devolved into, you know, not, I wouldn't say anarchy, but sort of conflict, but that conflict was sort of heavily racialized and there were suspicions of people came to the fore.
Well, a couple of things. One, you know, the media played a really bad role there because early on after Katrina, there were all these reports of violence and rioting in the Superdome. Like the police chief too of New Orleans, you know, talked about babies being raped in the Superdome, and there was this impression watching that, you know, there was just anarchy if you were inside this shelter, the 20,000, 25,000 people in there, and it turns out so much of that was just inflated. Four or five people died. One committed suicide. The other four, you know, heart attack, heat stroke, whatever. There's no murder, no reported rapes. And, you know, so some of it was just kind of this overblown where, you know, suddenly people were scared. And so they bring in the guns. They bring in the, you know, that attitude. But it was more than that. The Gretna Bridge, there's a bridge that connects Central Business District, the downtown New Orleans, to the West Bank, the, you know, largely white suburbs across the Mississippi River, the, you know, the huge bridge, Crescent City Connection officially, but everyone calls it the Gretna Bridge. And it's a state-run bridge, but on their own, the sheriff for the local parish county on the other side of the bridge in the West Bank and the town of Gretna, they just decide on their own, we're going to shut down the bridge. There's too many black folks walking from flooded New Orleans into the suburbs, which were dry. I mean, they didn't have electricity, but it was dry. They wasn't the same kind of catastrophe. And they just put police cars blocking the bridge, officers with rifles shooting over people's head if they came close. And so you had flooded New Orleans for several days. People, the only way out from the downtown of New Orleans is over this bridge to get to safety. And they weren't permitted. I just imagine a New York City, like, you know, Manhattan wants to get out, but Queens says no. It was really ugly. I mean, one of these things we tell ourselves, it happened after September 11th. I think it's happening from what I could tell now in Houston is, we all become Americans. We all join together. And that did not happen in New Orleans. And that continued through the recovery, but that's a separate issue.
So Gary, in your view, what we're seeing in Houston then looks something like an effective response, or at least not a terrible one?
Right. I mean, it's an awful circumstance. I mean, all things considered, again, using Katrina as the baseline for this is what a bad response looks like.
Yeah.
It's been good. But, once the rain stops, that's when the hard part starts. That's when it's sort of like this existential pain, should I rebuild? Can I rebuild? Will anybody help me rebuild? You think it's going to take a few months. No, it's probably going to take a couple of years. That's the experience in New Orleans. For entire communities come back, you're thinking in your head it's a year or 2 years. No, it's probably closer to 10 years. New Orleans, is more of a 10-year battle to come back. And, there are some communities, largely black communities in New Orleans that 11, 12 years, well, it's 12 years now after Katrina, they're not back. The lower Ninth Ward is probably only about half back after Katrina. The 10-year anniversary of Katrina, there were 100,000 fewer African Americans living in New Orleans than there were at the time of Katrina in a city of 455,000. And if the policies that are in place have a bias to them, as they did in New Orleans after Katrina, that's going to hurt the recovery for those of lower income, for those of color. There's suddenly going to be countless people hitting their insurance companies all at once. In New Orleans, people complained all the time. I'd send in my records and they'd lose it. I'd have to send it again. I'd have one agent come out to check things, but then they would be fired. They'd change jobs and have to go through this a second time, a third time. It just takes forever. FEMA. Oh my God, dealing with FEMA. And, it's not even the people who's in charge so much as the rules. It's this arcane procedures, this endurance test for how do you get reimbursed from the government. There's just a really broken system, and I don't care who the president is or the governor or the head of FEMA. That system has to be fixed, because the truth is the pain lies ahead more than right now.
You just sort of tackled so much of what I was going to ask you, so let's drill down into sort of two particular things. The first is that it seems to me that the rebuilding question for Houston is going to be especially acute, because part of the reason why the flooding has been so bad is that Houston was built up, was sprawling without any real concern for the effects of something like major flooding. And so what do those conversations look like? How does a region, how does a country begin to think about rebuilding in places that probably shouldn't have been built up in the first place?
That's an easy question to answer, because I sat through those in New Orleans for weeks, for months after Katrina. It was a different set of circumstances. I would not call New Orleans a sprawl city like Houston, but it was the same kind of issue that, because of technology, because of pumps, New Orleans really did expand into low-lying, below sea level areas. And so there are some neighborhoods that, built on swamp essentially, and they're 6-8 feet below seawater in a very vulnerable area. It's right on the fringe, if you look at a map, of the Gulf of Mexico. And there was this big debate about shrinking the footprint. Let's make New Orleans a taller, smaller city. Let's do some more infilling. Let's not bring back some of the neighborhoods that are in the greatest harm's way. And you're hearing this from geologists and other experts, but people live there. It was their neighborhood. Because of racial geography in New Orleans, it meant the high ground was taken by the time banks started loaning money into African Americans who wanted to buy a home. So guess what? Guess who lived in the lower lying areas in New Orleans, these newer communities? African Americans. There was a map that this commission came up with, and Bring New Orleans Back Commission, just trying to answer the kind of question you just posed. What should we do? Should we let every neighborhood back? Should we shrink the footprint? And they put this map up of here's neighborhoods that we're thinking of getting rid of. Well, you would have gotten rid of 80%, literally 80% of the African Americans in New Orleans would have been told you can't come back. So it's a hard discussion. It's my neighborhood. You're telling me I can't move back into my home. It's America. I own my home. It's property. Then you do the overlay of race, and it just became impossible in New Orleans to shrink the footprint. And they rebuilt all of New Orleans, and what you see is some neighborhoods are only half, two-thirds occupied, and there's a stronger levee system, so the area is safer than it was prior to Katrina. But there are still these low-lying areas that have thousands of people living in them that are, I'd be very scared there if there was a big hurricane about to hit New Orleans.
Now, I know you've written about, quite specifically, this the racial question here, the racial dynamics of New Orleans post-Katrina. And you're not an expert in Houston, but just for me as an observer, it seems like we may end up running into kind of a similar similar discussions, at least similar problems, because the low-income, predominantly African-American areas of Houston are on lower ground, were the first to be flooded, you know, involve people who may not be able to afford to rebuild or repair. And so in New Orleans, could you talk a little bit about that? Talk a little about the dispersal, about the fact that, you know, historic communities are basically kind of wiped out by the flood and the aftermath.
Well, and I want to add one more piece to that, and that's appraised value of land. This is another way that a structural racial bias plays a big impact. Let me get specific in New Orleans. This big city park it's called, in New Orleans. And on one side is Lakeview, white, middle-class, professional-class neighborhood, completely covered, 8 feet of water after Katrina. On the other side of City Park, Gentilly, black, middle-class neighborhood, devastated after Katrina. Well, your average three-bedroom, two-bathroom house in Lakeview was valued, appraised at $300,000, $350,000. That same house in Gentilly, same neighborhood essentially, just on the other side of the park, was appraised at $175,000, $180,000. It's a black neighborhood, so supposedly it's not as worth as much, even though it's the same house. And what the state did is came with this program, is federal dollars, Road Home, the largest housing recovery program in U.S. history. And they based it not on the cost of rebuilding, which is the reality for most people. It's the reality if your home is covered in water, but based on the appraised value. So you get some money from the insurance company, and Road Home was going to make you whole up to $150,000. And so the person has a $350,000 house. Let's say got $250,000 in insurance. Road Home gives another $100,000. They have $350,000 to rebuild. Great, they could do it. Same house in Gentilly. Let's say $150,000 in insurance, extra $30,000 from Road Home. Well, I only have $180,000. Roofing material, contractors, plumbers, they all cost the same, whether you're black, white, or green, doesn't make a difference. And so all these people in Gentilly couldn't rebuild because they didn't have enough money, because they stupidly, crazily based the whole program on assessed value, appraised value, rather than the cost of rebuilding. There was a racial discrimination suit. Of course, took forever. Finally, a judge ruled in favor of the black homeowner, saying, yes, this system was biased. But by that time, the $10 billion program had a few hundred million dollars in it, and it was largely too late for most. And you know, it was just a cockamamie system that, you know, ensured that it was harder for black residents in New Orleans, in most cases, to rebuild than white residents.
So one last question, since we're running out of time here. For those of us observing Hurricane Harvey and the aftermath and the rebuilding, what lessons should we take away from the experience of New Orleans? And what should we be watching for as time moves on to make sure that we don't repeat the mistakes of New Orleans?
Well, it's how are you helping people rebuild? Houston has this huge problem, or the Houston area has a huge problem, that the New Orleans area wasn't as acute there. And that's the lack of flood insurance. In New Orleans, if you were in the low-lying areas, you know, many people, most people, especially if they had a mortgage, the bank required it, had flood insurance. Well, most people in the Houston area don't have flood insurance. I don't know enough about it, but I guess it was not required because of flood maps and all that kind of thing. And so whereas there's the National Flood Insurance, a federal program, you know, helping out in New Orleans and the surrounding area, that came up to like $20 billion or something that National Flood Insurance paid. That's not going to be there in Houston. And so the question is, where is that money going to come from? People need help. I mean, this was a disaster. Their homes have been destroyed. Insurance will cover some, but not all. Can't just write off Houston, fourth largest city in our country. And I just don't know how it's going to play out. One advantage that New Orleans had after Katrina is George Bush was hit so hard. The coverage was so terrible that even though he was a conservative Republican, around, especially around spending, he pushed very hard on New Orleans' behalf, Southern Louisiana's behalf, to bring in money. And he fought his own party to make sure that Road Home and other programs like that were funded. Today, I don't know. You know, money is so tight, you know, shrinking the government, shrinking business, shrinking taxes. You know, I mean, the same week we're talking about Houston's future, we have the president in Missouri saying we're going to slash corporate taxes by, he hopes, more than 50% and slash personal taxes. And, you know, it's like, okay, so there's going to be less money. I don't know where the help is going to come from for Houston, because it's largely not going to be the flood protection, flood insurance program.
We have been speaking with Gary Rivlin, author of Katrina After the Flood. Thank you, Gary, for joining us on TrumpCast. It was a very interesting conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that's the show for today. If you don't already know, we'll be live from Austin's Texas Union Theater on Saturday, September 23rd at 7:30 p.m. Jacob Weisberg, Virginia Heffernan, and myself will be joined by former New York Times executive editor Joe Abramson and Congressman Joaquin Castro. For more information and tickets to the show, go to slate.com/live. That's slate.com/live. Today's show was produced by Jason DeLeon, with help from Afim Shapiro and AC Valdez. I'm Jamel Bowie. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.